This is the Graceful Atheist Podcast. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Graceful Atheist Podcast. My name is David, and I am trying to be the Graceful Atheist. For those of you in the U.S., I hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving time, a time of gratitude. I hope it was safe and masked up, socially distanced. I'm glad we're back together here. Please do consider sharing the podcast with a friend. That is how the podcast will grow. Quick exciting announcement that the next episode will be with my wife, Michelle, and we are discussing being unequally yoked and still loving each other. We had that conversation a few weeks ago. It is something I'm really looking forward to sharing with you. Don't miss that upcoming episode. On to today's show. My guest today is Colin in a Deconversion Anonymous episode. Colin is a natural-born storyteller and a comedian, which will become immediately apparent in our conversation. One of the fun things about doing this podcast is when you come across people who have independently come to very similar conclusions. That was true of my previous guest, Barrett Evans, and that is true of Colin as well. We're not using the same terminology, but what we are describing is a need to love people and to have that be an active, grounding part of our life. That comes across in Colin's story immediately. Colin's story is also one of having been raised in an evangelical environment and the long-lasting impact that that has made on him to this day. Colin is very honest about having gone to therapy. He shares both a heartbreaking and funny story about being a virgin later in life and the process of changing that fact. But most of all, what you're going to hear is real honesty, real vulnerability, and real heartfelt care and love for the people around him. Quick note about the editing process. Colin and I just had such a good time, and I laughed so much, and the conversation was very organic. I rearranged some of the conversation to be more thematic. For some of the harder edits that are a little jarring, I've got a little pause music break in there. You might be used to thinking that's the end, so please stick through to the end. And of course, I'll have final thoughts at the end of the episode. Here's my conversation with Colin. Colin, welcome to the Graceful Atheist Podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Your story is just deeply compelling, Colin, and I am excited for us to get into it. We'll start with really the beginning. What was your life like growing up?
Well, I was raised, you know, Christianity was part of my life as far back as I can really remember. Technically, I didn't get involved in it until I was about six.
Okay. The ripe old age.
But I didn't, you know, I didn't do a lot of epic stuff before that. So
yes,
there really was no before and after. It was just sort of my upbringing. My parents split up when I was three and moved to opposite sides of the country. And my mom remarried. And part of this separation experience, which was very difficult for both my parents and for me, my mom had a born-again conversion experience. It really changed her life. It led her to take responsibility, to be a better person in a lot of ways. And it, because I was mainly with her in terms of a custody perspective, I absorbed my mother's religion. I mean, completely. It was really all I knew. You know, church every Sunday, but then there was Sunday school beforehand. There was Sunday night, you know, worship service of some kind, Tuesday night Bible study, Wednesday night Christian Boy Scouts. I mean, I was just deeply immersed in this world. I shouldn't pass over this. Friday nights was Christian clown rehearsals.
Of course it was.
I don't want to leave that one out. I loved connecting with people. I loved laughing. I always kind of had an itch to be a performer, but my whole world kind of came through the lens of the church version of everything. So I feel like I grew up surrounded by people who laughed a lot,
yeah,
who were very intentional about living a good life, were very respectful of authority. We had Sunday lunches at friends' houses, and you know, I mean, it was very positive,
right?
In almost every way. The only times it got strange were when I would interact with somebody outside of the, you know, the sort of hermetically sealed little world,
right,
that I was in.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really interesting. Number one, for people like yourself who grow up in it, you don't know anything else. I think we have this tendency, especially maybe online, to only look back at the negatives. And there certainly are negatives, and I imagine that we'll get to those. But it's also okay to say, hey, you know, the thing that Christianity or religion in general does really well is build community.
Oh, so well.
Probably had people that you loved, and you loved hanging out with them on Sunday afternoons. And, you know, so there are good things about the community that gets built around religion.
I know. I feel like I'm sort of setting up this shift, you know, it's like dun, dun, dun.
Yes.
But that's not actually like tactical. You'll find this. I'm a very positive person. I see the good in everyone. It doesn't mean it's always an automatic reflex. I have to work at it, but it's hard for me to give weight to some of the negative experiences the same way, because I do really feel like it was a lot of good people who were trying. And, you know, now that I'm an adult, I also understand that, you know, adults have no idea what they're doing.
Right. Everybody's winging it.
So for me to put them on this pedestal of like, how could they brainwash me, or how could they tell me the answer when they weren't sure? It's like, I now understand as an adult, that's what you do. You do the best you can.
Yeah.
And you don't have all of the pieces connected. In fact, I think that's a much more interesting place to start than, oh no, I have all the pieces connected.
Right.
I have no doubt. There's no holes in the armor. You know, that's intense.
Absolutely. In some of our dialogue over email, one quote that hit me, you said, looking back, every time I was exposed to something outside Christianity, it made a bigger impact on me than Christianity did itself. What exactly did you mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a great place to go next. I went to public school, so I interacted with, quote unquote, what we were told were non-believers. And I was kind of taught to be careful, to sort of hold them at arm's length.
Yeah.
Unless I was trying to evangelize to them.
Right.
And, you know, I did try to start a Bible study in my middle school. Like I felt like I was following the hero's journey of being a youth group kid, right? Like I was making a stand.
Right.
And I'm in a weird way proud that I was a nonconformist. However, conformity is much more motivating.
Yes.
Especially when you're like 11, you know, like right. I just wanted to fit in. And I liked all of the kids that I went to school with. I mean, I didn't necessarily see them as lost or as
right
selfish, or some of the rhetoric that I was really being taught, you know, incapable of understanding spiritual things. It just wasn't my experience. And it sort of got more problematic from there, because I have such a strong sense of inclusion. And around this age, around 10 or 11, I had a female Sunday school teacher who was dynamite. I mean, she was a character. She taught a lesson with verve,
yeah,
with hermeneutics, you know, like right. she was wonderful intellect and kind of a fun, great speaker. And so I remember asking my parents, you know, why doesn't she preach? I mean, she's extraordinary. And they said, we believe it's not right for a woman to teach a man. And I was like, no, nope.
Right.
Like that is wrong. But this is important. I was a little kid. I mean, I had no agency to act on that.
Right.
So that was my first, I think now, moment where I was like, oh, I'm actually a feminist, or at least I'm definitively on the side of equality, equal rights and equal access. And my church sort of was at odds with it.
Right.
And I was surprised to find that.
Absolutely. The thing I want to jump off on here is I've heard from a number of people that I interview where they describe being a child, even younger than what you're describing, and having some moral sense, some ethical sense as a kid of this is not right. And just as you describe, not having quite the agency or the ability to speak into the adults' lives, to use a churchism.
Good one.
But I find that fascinating that, you know, you were really exerting your moral autonomy by recognizing that difference.
Yeah. And, you know, unfortunately, you think that it is doubts. You think it is a weakness on your part to not be able to follow the plan, so to speak, and plan with a capital P, you know, you feel like you're in this, you're in the lane you're supposed to be in, and you should be grateful. And I was, but I was also like, this is not okay. And I don't have any language for why this is. So I just sort of stuffed it down. The next big example was finally meeting my stepmom's brother, who is a gay man, and meeting his partner and having all of these feelings come up of like, I'm supposed to witness to them. I'm supposed to change them, you know, be a model of God's love and turn them away from whatever choices they've made. And it was just like, what does any of that have to do with the fact that these two men are just amazing people,
right?
Like funny, kind, amazing hosts. And also, like, and I think this is very important, just wanted to be left alone.
Right.
They didn't have some like crusade they were on.
Yeah.
You know, I'd certainly been taught about the gay agenda. Gosh, I haven't thought about that phrase. I've thought about that phrase in a long time, but I was like, there's no agenda.
Right.
They just want to live their life. And so yet again, the sort of homophobia that had been built into my framework, I'm actually quite proud to say, just sort of disintegrated almost immediately.
Right.
I was like, well, I choose them because these are wonderful people. And it was, of course, at the time, very scary because this was another big sort of failure on my part to fit the Christian mold. Mm.
I think it's so important as well that just in general, the way that we as human beings make judgments about other human beings, it's easy to categorize a group that we are not a member of. And once you actually meet a member of said group, it is much harder to hate that person.
Yeah.
Especially in a, you know, your uncle and a nephew, somebody who you have a built-in reason to care about or spend any significant amount of time with. It's hard to hate somebody that you actually know. And I feel like there's so much, particularly within the church, but even just in politics today, where we are hating one another because we aren't interacting with each other. We don't actually know someone who thinks differently than we do.
You know, I'm so glad you mentioned that. I think that's a great insight. And I think it's, you know, I'm going to become annoying in this way and say, I don't think this is always malicious. I think sometimes it's unintentional. Mm. When you lack exposure, you start saying things like, all liberals are like this, or all conservatives are like this, and there's nobody to kind of push you to think a little more critically. And I am concerned to see a lot of that us versus them rhetoric that I grew up with now happening on such a large scale.
Yeah.
In many different respects, but certainly in politics. And it really breaks my heart because, well, this is just my perspective. I don't think being right is really the goal. I think the I think the goal is to gain an understanding of how the other person thinks.
Yeah.
And to respect them for doing so. And I just, something I like to do, which probably gets me in trouble, is I like to engage in conversations with people I know I'm not going to agree with, because I just like the fact that we're getting along.
Right.
I'm like, see, it can happen.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's a danger that when you're not exposed to people different from you, you do sort of create this caricature. And I certainly had one about people outside of Christianity. And I was raised quite fundamentalist. doctrinally, it was Calvinism. Mm. And it was very serious. And it was, you know, some of the implications of that were really dangerous for me as a young person, because I didn't have the ability to understand, you know, God is holding me in his angry hand, trying not to smash me down.
Right.
But he can't, because Jesus died for me, which is kind of my fault.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not, I really don't want to like create any straw men and then like knock them over. It's not really my goal. I just think as a little kid, like it's really hard not to internalize a story like that and be like, well, obviously the problem is me. There's something wrong with me. And I think there's a lot of shame that comes out of just some of the messaging is just really, it's very advanced and intense. And
I've written about and talked about, you know, you're not broken, you're human.
Yeah. Oh yeah. That's nice.
You know, to err is human. That is, you know, what it means. I do want to make clear that I'm not interested in just tearing down Christianity either. Yeah. That isn't the purpose of the podcast. This isn't the purpose of you and I talking today, but it is illustrative to talk about that the message can be internalized, even more so for someone who grows up with knowing nothing else. I often talk about having come to it in my late teens. And even though I wasn't yet an adult, I had some sense of an independent, who I was as a person, independent of the things that I believed or the people around me. And I think that has really protected me from the hardest, most traumatic experiences that I see from many, many people. And that message of you are broken, it's impossible not to internalize that.
Boy, yeah, that's well said. I sort of envy you that on some level, just because, yeah, like I said, you know, at four, I wasn't like traveling around Europe and, you know, having conversations with interesting strangers. You know, I didn't have anything to compare it to.
Yeah.
And I did internalize the message that I was broken. I internalized messages like hate the sin, not the sinner. I mean, show me how you're supposed to apply that. I'm not really sure. That stuff is very hard to apply. And I, as a young person dealing with my parents' divorce, I mean, this is a sort of separate factor, really internalized the message that I was in some way an outsider or alone. Mm-hmm. Each of my parents recreated a new family. And so I sort of flew between them as the half brother and the stepson.
Okay.
And, you know, as a kid, I mean, I didn't know it at the time. I was like, I don't have a family. I don't fit in any of these two groups. And I had a profound sense of aloneness and outsiderness. And I think when you don't have the ability to control anything, you find something you can control. And what I could control was I could have horrible thoughts about myself sort of all day, you know, for years. As an adult, I'm still dealing with the after effects of that.
In your writing, you mentioned my first and only religion is inclusion. I love the way you say that. You know, I talk about this thing called secular grace, and it's mostly just recognizing the humanity and the people around us. And the things that we want as a fully autonomous human being, we need to be willing to give those same rights, freedoms, dignity, respect.
Yeah, for sure.
Kindness to the people around us. And all of this sounds super trite, and I'm aware of that. But it actually is super powerful when you show some kindness to people. The effect is profound.
I mean, I totally agree. And I know that you do this because just the way that you say, I'm trying to be the graceful atheist, like that spoke to me the first time I heard it. And every time I've become a fan, I've absorbed a bunch of your episodes, and that's what it is. Like, we're just trying to be the best version of ourselves. And, you know, I don't know what I would call myself. I don't really have a group or an affiliation that I can really think of, but I like that idea of trying to be graceful and trying to be, give people the benefit of the doubt and look for their humanity. I mean, I'm a sucker for that. And, you know, as a storyteller, that's like That's the whole thing for me, is don't tell me the grand mountaintop moment. Tell me the moment this morning when you were chasing your dog around the yard, right? You took your shoe, you know, like that's so human and relatable and just as interesting on some level as accomplishments.
I don't want to lose the thread of you telling your story, but that is such a good segue to just talk about that comedy is a part of the work that you do.
Yeah.
And I always find, and maybe this is just obvious, but that the best comedy is about some of the most trivial, mundane things about being a human. It is that recognition of, oh, I do that, or I think that, you know, that is kind of the basis of comedy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really remarkable. And it's remarkable the first time you use it to your advantage, you know, because when you're standing in an open mic in front of an audience and you choose to say something, I'm going to give you one that just popped to my head. Part of I've managed depression and anxiety throughout my life. And so one time I started talking about my eating habits when I'm depressed, which was absolutely not public information, right. But in a comedy club, it's like, who cares? If you can make it funny, go for it.
Yeah.
And I said, I think one Christmas, someone in my family got me like a Costco bottle of like Raisinets.
Yeah.
I just camped out in my apartment and that's like all I ate. So I think the joke goes, I one time ate Raisinets for 2 days straight, and you can tell yourself there's raisins in there. That is not going to make you feel better. It's so simple. Yes. It's so minor, but it was like, you could see a way that people would laugh that just felt like, yes, me too.
Right.
You know, mine's pizza or mine's Honey Nut Cheerios or mine's ice cream or whatever. And I would feel such a sense of connection and acceptance from things like that.
Right.
Yeah. To that point about like getting the benefit of your humanity rather than trying to like manage the way it comes out.
Right. So we'll come back to comedy. Let's try to pick the thread back up again. So you had a number of instances where outside influences made you think in a way that Christianity hadn't. And so let's pick that back up. What, like,
yeah,
how old were you when you started to have more serious doubts?
Yeah, well, I went to Christian high school and Christian college, and I really fit that mold really well. There's a couple of places. After college, I did a mission trip.
Okay.
And I was a virgin, not surprisingly.
Okay.
But I was also like very anti premarital sex because I was raised in that generation of true love waits and,
right,
and all that stuff. First off, I didn't want to evangelize to anybody because it felt totally forward. Like, I don't even know you. Why would I ask you where you're going to go when you die? So I was kind of like a bad missionary, like, right. I was like, I'm screwing this up. And to make matters worse, I hung out with a couple of local guys one night, and one of them found out that I was a virgin. It was probably like, I don't know, early 20s.
Okay.
And he started, for lack of a better word, evangelizing me on the joys of, you know, having sex. And yeah, I was like, this guy's making a lot of good points. Like, my argument it pales in comparison. Yeah. And so I think there was just this like lack of a true, I'm going to throw myself into the brink for this message. I was just more curious than anything else.
Right.
The other thing that really created a lot of doubt and inner turmoil was that I fell in love with movies at a very young age.
Okay.
And I was sort of, you know, the obvious reaction was these movies have violence, they have sexuality, they have obscene language. Like, this is not of God. This is, you know, not to be consumed. But obviously, I mean, I wasn't raised, I guess, thankfully, in such a removed environment that people did watch movies. Like, it wasn't odd. But I sort of wandered into the R-rated action movie terrain, as most teenage boys.
Sure. Like a perfectly normal person.
That's the market. Yeah. And I feel at tremendous odds with this, and yet I love them. I would always feel transported. And I can recall, I have this very vivid image of, I would rent movies at the, you know, Blockbuster near my house. And then I would sit in my basement. The only TV in our house was next to my room, which was also in the basement. I would sit there in this little chair, armchair or something, right up in front of the TV, like right near the TV with my hand on the power button, so that if I heard my parents' footsteps down the stairs in the basement, I could just turn it off. And that seems very suspicious.
Like that, yes.
That's the posture of somebody who, you know, like it need, this is a secret. But yeah. But the reality is,
and normal people, Colin, are watching porn when they do that.
Yeah, well, yeah, porn. Yeah, it's exactly what it is. It's like, yeah. It's so funny because yes. I was like so sheltered. I didn't even know about porn. I was like literally watching some movie that was like with a script and a budget and was still like ashamed of it. And the reason was I knew I couldn't explain why I loved it. And it's actually even still a little bit difficult to find the words to say why I just love stories. I love the experience. And my friend in youth group's parent was a media librarian at a local university, and he was a big film buff, and he saw no conflict, even though he was also part of my Christian community. And so he found out that I love movies, and he was like, well, have you seen John Woo? Right. And started like gave me a list of Hong Kong action movies to watch. So yeah. This was the first conflict. It's like, how do you explain what appears to be violence to somebody who really feels uncomfortable with that? And I feel like my mom was just very black and white about it. And so I knew I couldn't explain that. And then from there, I branched into dramas. And I can remember watching the movie Before Sunrise, like Ethan Hawke, 90s kind of just walk around and talk. And I've always loved these kind of dramas where the characters are like real people to me.
Yes.
And here are these two people walking around Europe, falling in love, talking about truth and beauty and art, and never, I mean, I think they talk about religion, but it's not really a factor in their connection. And so I would watch these stories, and in some ways they were my portal to a more interesting, more, I don't know, exploratory type of life. Even as I lived in this Christian world, I sort of felt like I was experiencing all of these different types of journeys. And I actually think now, like, how grateful I am because they gave me other options. There were other ways to go when I got old enough to kind of choose my own way.
First of all, just all Ethan Hawke movies in the 90s, I think. If you're, I don't know how old you are, but Gen X, I mean, that's just, you totally relate to all of those.
Sure.
But just that philosophical, I so totally wanted to be like Ethan Hawke.
Oh, yeah.
He is so, so cool, yeah. And, you know, now as a humanist, on the other side, I can see it. I don't want to put words in your mouth, Colin, but that what we did as Christians is we had one book. We had one source of information and storytelling. And then as you experience all these other facets of art that express the diversity of the human experience, and you feel just as much awe, just as much emotion and passion as you're experiencing that art, that provides some cognitive dissonance. Was that your experience?
It sure does. Yeah. You know, I think about that young man sort of sitting in that chair in the basement, and I think just how much pressure, how squeezed I was to sort of not love a thing that I loved. Mm-hmm. And it makes me a little sad because I didn't know that I didn't have to make my case to my Christian community. I would eventually be able to just love it because I love it.
Right.
And I think that because I didn't know about that option, I did feel extremely trapped. Fortunately, my love of it led me to a film school in LA where I met other, you know, there were Christians there as well who were like, I love, you know, Steven Spielberg movies. And I love, I mean, it didn't really matter what it was. It was just like, or like Fellini. Like I got into some really cool stuff that I hadn't been exposed to. And it was just more people who were willing to live more of, like, I guess we would have called it a pluralistic life. Like, they were just more open to ambiguity. And I just continued down that path as I got older. I traveled around Europe. I just met people who were outside of Christianity, and I just didn't see it as a big barrier. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'd always wanted to be a performer, and I ended up one day going to a comedy class and getting into comedy. And that was, you know, that Raisinette's comment I made earlier was like a tiny little example of, I could just be completely honest.
Oof. Yeah.
There was no, like, I didn't have to present myself as this ideal believer or, you know, deeply faithful person. Like, I could talk about how screwed up I felt.
Yeah.
It allowed me to talk about depression. And it even allowed me, as I sort of moved further down that path, I got into storytelling. I started telling stories about growing up Christian to rooms of people who were not Christian, and people ate it up. And it was the weirdest thing. Like, I don't think me as a kid would believe it if I said, like, some of these experiences you're going through that feel so unique and like no one will ever understand are universal.
Absolutely.
They're gold. Like, don't, you know, write stuff down. Don't lose them. You know, I would have never guessed that would be the case.
Yeah. And to quote you one more time, you said, I found unconditional acceptance immediately outside of religion, whereas I often found highly conditional acceptance within it. Imagine my surprise.
Yeah. So as I dated and met more people, like, my very narrow world opened up. It opened up all the way to where I went on a yoga retreat.
Oh, wow. Man, that's edgy, man.
Which is, yeah, exactly. That's so benign. And yet for me was like, what's going to happen? You know, it's like, people are going to stretch quietly. That's it. And yes. While I was there, I got into a conversation around a campfire with some people, and a guy a bit older than me asked, I guess he had heard that I was raised Christian, and I don't know. I said, yeah, you know, from a young age, I really thought that there was something bad about me and fundamentally bad about me. And that just by clinging to this belief that I could maybe overcome that. And this guy said to me, I'm so sorry that happened to you.
Wow.
It just rung my bell. I was like, oh yeah. Like, this was not healthy. And I didn't know how to talk about this. And here's what I would say. It didn't work for me. There's a lot of people that it appears to work for. That's great. I want everybody to find something that works for them.
Right, right.
And I would prefer that thing doesn't motivate you to step on other people's thing. Right. So I know that's a bit Pollyanna, but I also think that's very relevant with some of the, like, merging of religion and political activism and legislation. Is like, that's not a fair ball. Like, right. That's, you've gone too far over the line. At the same time, I think it's great to find something that fills you with purpose and community and joy and allows you to grow and challenge yourself. And for me, it was more about performing and storytelling and speaking. I just found it more in that space.
Right.
It was very hard to leave. I know when I sort of left in my early 30s, I guess, I'd been kind of going to different churches all through my 20s. Man, I really hung on for a long time, even though it wasn't bringing me any clear positive result.
Yeah.
I'll tell you why. The reason I never left was because I was afraid that when you do, you lose everything. You lose salvation, community, identity.
Yeah.
You know, and community, I mean, you mentioned that earlier, was in some ways the biggest blow, because I sort of didn't know how to make friends. You know, this is what I love about churches. Every once a week, a bunch of people show up in the same space who are, like, really trying to live a better life. And so you have great conversation, and you know, people kind of do the, how are you? No, really, how are you?
Like, right.
It's great.
Yeah. I think something that our secular friends who never were religious at all don't understand is how compelling walking into a church building and having 20 people say, I love you, and meaning it. That is deeply, deeply compelling.
Yeah. We're
hardwired as human beings to be in community and to connect with each other. And that is super, super powerful. Now, there's nothing supernatural going on there. We can do that in the secular community, in a non-church environment, but we need to actually do that. That's the thing that we're missing.
Yeah, agreed. You know, it's that structure piece is so valuable, and it's definitely missing, or I should say I miss it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's, you know, I mentioned it earlier, like it did feel conditional. Like there's a pretty large commitment that is required to get those benefits. And I just felt more and more like it conflicted with my truer set of values.
Yeah.
Which is like, I need you to know, like, you're in the circle with me. Like, I got you. I'm not going to let you go. And I think, especially as a person with a lot of privilege who kind of became aware of it later in life, because privilege is invisible, you know, to the people who have it, I should say, to the people who have it. I felt it was my moral obligation to be more inclusive, not less, and to be looking out for people whose experience was different from mine. And I just, that's one thing where church sometimes, for me at least, struggled, is that it fit the demographics of my region, which tended to skew very much people like me.
The common thread that you've talked about is just honesty, whether that's in comedy or not. But I think it takes a tremendous amount of self-honesty to see one's privilege, right? To see where I have been privileged many, many, many times throughout my life, even though part of my personal story was poverty, right? Doesn't matter. I still had this tremendous amount of privilege in my life. And so it sounds like you recognize that as well. So you've mentioned that you went to therapy, and as we know, many times in the Christian world, therapy is looked down upon. So I'm curious, what led up to that, besides the obvious of starting to recognize depression? How did you give yourself permission to do so? And then what was it like?
Oh man, I was in my late 20s. I had been depressed at many points, but I was so depressed I couldn't work. It was really, really intense. And someone gave me a business card of a therapist. And it was like, it never occurred to me to explore that option.
Right.
And I think if it ever did, I was definitely explicitly taught, beware the counsel of the unenlightened. You know, the wisdom of man and the wisdom of God are very clearly two different buckets. And so I met with this person because I was just so incapacitated, and he just normalized everything that I was experiencing, like just almost just by the way he spoke. And I would sit in this little office with him and I would say these things that were like, I'd never told anyone. And he would just go like, okay. Anything else? You know, like he just didn't, I couldn't phase him.
Yeah.
And not only that, I mean, that to me is love, for lack of a better word. I mean, I was being totally authentic and I was being totally accepted.
Yeah.
And so that, I think on some level, became a better representation of, let's call it church, or let's call it the kind of person that I wanted to be. I'd never really experienced that unconditionalness before. And I did a lot of work with that person. And one of the things that he enabled me to do was to look at myself as somebody with something to say. You know, I really got into a place where I just thought the world didn't need me. I didn't have value. I didn't have a message or a story worth sharing. And I know that that is very common. And the interesting thing is, when you start telling your story, that's when you realize people want to hear it. Sometimes you have to kind of do the work first.
Yeah.
And I know with this therapist, like I must have been his model client because he would give me these big homework assignments. Like, I want you to have a real conversation with your dad. And I'd come back 2 weeks later and be like, I did it. It was crazy. You know, I was really devoted to trying a different method. And the other big thing, that I was a virgin very late into my 20s, and he helped me, I think, love myself enough to like be open to relationships and to eventually like cross over that like fairly unextraordinary threshold.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
Yeah, well, you're really taught, and I'm sad to think that I was taught this will be a moment of lifelong regret that you will never come back from. I definitely read Joshua Harris, I Kissed Dating Goodbye, and I was very much in that world. And I remember after that happened, feeling not shame, but pride. Because I was like, I just made a choice that required me to trust myself, and that is on my terms. And I was like, I like this guy. And that was the beginning of me sort of trying to live a really big life intentionally. I started doing stand-up comedy because it scared me. I started telling stories, and storytelling really allowed me to be vulnerable, which it was only just at that point that Brené Brown was starting to talk about vulnerability, and you're starting to go like, oh, this is cool. This is, we all need to be more genuine. But I was experiencing that in these ways that were like, they were almost miraculous. I really think, like, I would share, I told a story about being a Christian clown when I was a kid. And it's a funny story, but I'll be honest with you, it's still a little hard for me to say that I did that because it's so dorky. And I would tell this story, and then I remember some woman in the audience came up to me after, and she said, I loved your story. And I said, it's funny, I didn't think anybody would relate. And she said, Colin, we were all 11.
Exactly.
Yeah. And yeah, I was like, that's the truth. You know, like, your unique experience, people relate to it on their own terms. It's not a one-to-one like, oh, I've experienced that, so I get it. It's more like the thematic resonance of, I also felt dorky and uncool. And this is just one example of that. And so for me, those moments, turning that pain into laughter, like owning the joke and owning the story, like sharing things about mental health that I couldn't believe I was putting out there, always felt like this tremendous form of power. And it was valuable. It was, people would say, thank you. I need to hear that. And so I just kept going, you know. Stop when you're getting that kind of feedback?
We've danced around it, but I want to hear the explicit, when was the moment that you admitted to yourself that you really didn't think that this Christianity thing was real, or whatever terms that you use? How was that like for you?
Yeah. Boy, that's a good question. The first moment you sense it is when you stop going to church and time goes by, you know, that kind of thing. And you go, wow, it's been a while. I mean, I grew up, I went to church every Sunday, so it was very evident to me. I don't live near my family, so it was an easy thing to sort of camouflage. But I stopped going to church and I started dating a woman who was not Christian. I like to say she's the most kind, most generous. She's the most spiritual person I've ever met. Mm-hmm. Never had a moment of church in her life.
Right.
So wrestle with that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
She didn't need that to become a truly good person. And I'm with this person and I'm starting to build this business where I'm speaking and I'm kind of seeing myself as a leader in a way that I'd never had before. Mm-hmm. And I stumble onto a podcast by a comedian I love, Pete Holmes. And his podcast, You Made It Weird, he always asks people, there are three areas. He talks about comedy, he talks about sex, and he talks about God. And the God part is because he was raised in church and he's been very open about that part of his story. And in the God part, he would just say, so like, what do you believe? And people would say whatever they believed. Mm-hmm. And he would go, I love that.
Yeah.
Yes. And it sounds so basic, but he gave me a pathway. He was like, you can be that person who doesn't have an agenda. Mm-hmm. Unless the agenda, I guess, for lack of a better, there's got to be a better word, but the agenda is, I just want to love and accept you. And I want to be loved and accepted.
Right.
And so in a way, listening to him, being with this person who is now my wife and is just my favorite person in the world, not going to church, I just kind of formed a new me. I formed a new center.
Yeah.
And it wasn't long after that, because it's very lonely, you know, having left that world, that I stumbled onto podcasts from, you know, the ex-evangelicals, Life After. And I got to say, I was dumbfounded. I did not know that my experience was as common as it was. I felt completely, in a way, adrift. Like I had lost it. I'd lost the plot. I was floating out to sea. It was all my fault. I mean, there was still that was in there because of all of my wiring, really, my upbringing. And then it became more and more normalized as I saw these people who were perfectly content, perfectly happy, good, living their life without this Christian framework. And, you know, I have family who is still Christian, and it's tricky for me because I just want them to be happy. And yeah. I feel an obligation not to ever press this issue with them, to make sure that they always know that I respect them and I respect their reasoning. And so it's been a little tricky because I don't feel like I can really tell them my story.
Right.
And I hate to say it, but part of the Christian story narrative is that if you fall away, your story stops.
Right.
And that's yes. really sad because yeah. I think, what is a more fair definition of courage than being willing to leave the only world you've ever known and trust yourself and strike out on your own and follow your truth? I mean, it was terrifying
yeah.
to walk out of those sort of metaphorical doors. And I now know, now that the lava has cooled a little bit, the wounds have healed, I'm just proud and I'm just glad that I did it. But, you know, it was really hard not to feel like I could talk about what was happening to me, because to talk about that would be to create dissension or challenge their beliefs. And I'd say I'm very fortunate. My family mostly just didn't bring it up.
Yeah.
You know, it's an advantage, a real privilege of leaving your religion as an adult. It's kind of like, okay, you know, it's yeah. not what I wanted for you, but yes. you know, and I know they're concerned, but I think there's also a level of like, you know, we see each other a couple times a year, so this is not that impactful.
I think this is important though. What you're saying is, again, being able to accept your family where they are at.
Yeah.
And then being hopeful that they can accept you where you're at. Maybe there's some asymmetry there, but it's important that we care about the people that we love who are still believers, even if we yeah. have moved on and feel some more freedom.
Yeah. And I understand some of the belief that makes that difficult. I understand the unilateral language of scripture, that this is the only way, you know, I understand, like, it puts them in a difficult position as well. But I really feel that my life and my story, if it has value, it's for someone to hear it and to feel like they're not alone.
Right.
And whatever that means. And so that's why I try to be honest, and I try to share both my embarrassing flaws and failures, as well as talk about some of the beautiful, you know, unforgettable moments that have happened in my life. I mean, I'm married to somebody who makes me laugh and who I make laugh every single day. And and we work so hard at our relationship, like,
yeah,
and we benefit from it. Like we really, it right. bears the fruit, and it's the lifelong project of my life. And I have created a career where I try to help other people tell their story in the best way possible. And being an entrepreneur is its own form of courage. You know, I don't know where the next paycheck is going to come. I also know that's not really what it's about. It's about helping people be authentic. Yeah. And so for me, I guess it's a long way of saying it. I apologize. It's just this idea that I just want to tell my story, and I want other people to tell their story. And I want us all to kind of sit in the room together and be like, I know you better.
Yes.
Thank you for your courage. That sort of thing. Like, I just want to see more of that.
Yeah. Again, one other resonance here is you're talking about that feeling of being alone, or hoping that your story can help people recognize that they are not alone. All of the indoctrination can lead a person to feel like they are truly the only bad person in the world as they go through some form of deconstruction or deconversion or what have you, or whatever terms again that we use, that as they begin that walk away to find themselves, that they are somehow uniquely terrible. And it is so cathartic to hear that you're just average, that so many other people have gone through a very, very similar experience. And the details are different here or there, but that other people have gone through this self-discovery process, have let go of beliefs that they found wanting at some point. And I think you telling your story is powerful. It is really important for people to hear.
Well, thank you. I mean, I will say I've been very fortunate in my life to have people come up to me after a story or after a speech, comedy show, whatever, and just say, like, I really feel connected to you. And I feel less alone because you told that story about your grandma, made me connect to my grandma who I just lost. And because of your story, I got to like be with her. And it was so special. And I've had people say things that make my head spin. Like, one storyteller told me, I'm jealous of your Christian upbringing.
Yeah.
Because it's such good fodder for
it's material
for stories. And I was like, okay, so you're jealous of my pain and yes. my angst and my confusion. But also, aren't those the hallmarks of a good story?
Yes, yes.
Like, point taken. And that is really been an advantage that I've had by being more of a public leaning communicator, is I get that feedback from people.
Yeah.
And so it is a profound and important reminder that you have a story and somebody needs to hear that story, and you don't know who it is. So you just got to get it out there. And the other thing is, people need help telling their story. Mm. And so just to listen, I brought up my grandma earlier. My grandma was the best listener I've ever met in my life. She could take a total stranger. I mean, she would literally take both of their hands and envelop them in this deep conversation about money and happiness and, you know, and it was this incredible. I mean, we never could get anywhere having these conversations, but yeah. It was incredible to watch. And I sort of, even as a young person, said, I want to be that any way I can. Mm. And, you know, I fail as much as I succeed, but I do really think we need more of that love and acceptance, less of that feeling of aloneness, less of that feeling of I'm waiting for you to be wrong so I can pounce. And, you know, who would have thought that I would discover that from just wanting to tell jokes?
I feel a drive to communicate, a drive to tell people who are listening that they are not alone, to express my story, to talk about this concept of grace. But talk about the drive for you to communicate, and what is the message that you are trying to get across?
Wow. It's an interesting question. In my 20s, I wanted to be a writer, and I was terrified of rejection. Mm. And so I would work really, really hard. I must spend hundreds of hours, honestly, writing screenplays and books and short stories. And then I would not submit them anywhere. I wouldn't let yes. friends read. It's a terrible business model.
Yes.
And, you know, by some random luck, I stumbled into this comedy class And it's so funny because you're in this class with like other students who want you to succeed. Like you can't fail. So you get up there and you make them laugh and you're like, this is all I want to do with my life now.
Yes. Yeah,
it is the most incredible feeling. And so, and in the back of your mind, you're like, I hope I don't ever fail because this feels so good. Right. And you shouldn't wonder if you're going to fail. You should know that you're going to fail.
Like yes.
it's going to happen so fast. It's going to hurt so bad. You're going to just be dazed.
Yeah.
And for me, I was getting instant feedback on what I was writing. And while what I was writing was not that significant, I loved the process of feedback. I actually started to find like, well, it's not really rejection. They're just saying that premise wasn't clear enough. So we were confused and that's why we didn't laugh.
Right.
Or, you know, another great one is when you try to get real, you look like maybe you were going to cry. And so we were all worried about you.
Right.
So I often, when I coach people, I often say like, you can tell any story from your life, no matter how painful, as long as the audience knows that you are okay, that this, you want to be telling this story. And so all that to say, the process of putting your message out into the world and getting feedback, I think is profoundly human and profoundly beneficial. Mm. Like, I know I told that story about the rejection piece, but it's like, that is so outweighed by the feeling of connection that you get. And so for me, I think it was the best accident that could have happened because I realized that it's not for me to communicate with my Word document and then save it away for no one to see. It's for me to share it with somebody else so that they can do something with it,
right?
Whether it's laugh, whether it's tell somebody else. And I think that led me directly into storytelling where I was like, now I am trying to talk about real things and I'm trying to talk about losing my faith and I'm trying to talk about losing my virginity, or I'm trying to talk about learning how to be okay in the brain of somebody with mental health, just realities. I mean, like all of us. And what I always found, and this is why I think communication is so beautiful and important, is that it's like, so what if you're on a stage, you're still just having a conversation and you are sharpened and you are shaped by the response that you get. Is that fair? Like that to me is the magic. Is like, and you're doing this too, which is so great because when you put your message out there and tell your story in different ways, you discover different parts of it and you discover parts that resonate. I love the interview where your friend who is not Christian interviews you. And, you know, I don't even know if this was intentional on his part, but what I took from it was how many quote unquote non-believers I was surrounded by who were totally ready to love me and accept me.
Yeah.
But there was this barrier of like, I don't know. He's really into this church thing and I don't know what that is. And
right.
I want to be respectful.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah. And I think I would have loved to have had some more friendships younger in my life and throughout my life that weren't so deep and profound and shame based and perfection oriented. And
yeah,
I would have loved that.
Yes, exactly.
I think that would have been very balancing for me. Ultimately, that's what I found my way to through communicating.
Part of my story is when my mom got into recovery, I fell apart. I wound up dropping out of high school. And part of the reason was that I hated public speaking and I had to do a number of projects in school where I had to get up in front of people and talk. So there was this thing that went by on Twitter a month or two ago that was, what would your 12-year-old self think about you now?
Mm-hmm.
And I jokingly said to my wife, you know, I do what are in effect public book reports by choice would have floored my 12-year-old self. So I'm curious, Colin, what would your 12-year-old self think about you now today?
Oh my gosh. I mean, first off, I love that. I even love that. I, for some reason, had the image of you and your 12-year-old self, like chatting and trying to find common ground. And
yes.
you know, I have to say in my case, I wonder if younger me would have liked me.
Yeah.
Because we were so oppositionally oriented in terms of this one, only this one specific thing of belief. I now understand that my religious experience was inviting me to find my way out, I suppose, yeah. or at least find what was true for me on my terms. And so a big part of why I'm having this conversation with you today is because I have learned how to love myself. And I said this the other day to someone, and it sort of shocked me, but I said, I have become the person that I always wanted to be.
Wow.
I did not know that as a young person. And yeah. I think within the framework of Christianity, I didn't think I'd be able to sit here from where I've arrived and say something like that. Because essentially I would have fallen away. I would have been the seed that fell on thorny ground.
Right.
And it's so weird how many of these are kind of recalling in my brain.
Yeah.
And yet I feel a tremendous sense of pride in the person that I have become. And I like to think that I had a sort of a deeper religion. I just didn't have words for it, which is, I just call it inclusion.
Right.
On a social level, a social scale, it's like, how can I unwind my privilege to distribute it to someone who didn't get it? But on a micro level, it's like, we're hanging out and you tell a bad joke and everybody kind of groans, I'm going in with you. I'm going to try and build off of your joke because I don't want you to feel that sense of, oh, I am the one who doesn't fit in this room in this moment. That's very powerful for me.
My headspace is in a slightly different place right now in that talking to apologists, talking to counter apologists, and I want to just say, stop.
You know, yeah.
What we need is some honesty, some vulnerability. Let's just talk to each other like human beings.
It's interesting because I do like listening to debates, and it is interesting to me. And certainly growing up in this world, I feel obligated to make an intellectual case for or against. Mm. But I'll tell you something that is kind of funny to admit. I read one of your blog posts where you do this beautiful, I recommend this to anybody, like this very thorough thought experiment to explore whether or not, you know, Christianity is true. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that I finished it, even though I was interested in it. This better not come out like a backhanded compliment. It's not.
Okay.
It's because those are not the terms that I need to believe or not believe something.
Right.
And so I guess in this moment, it's occurring to me to say, you know, if you're listening to this and you feel obligated that you have to prove the case for or against, I don't think that that is the only way. Like, I experienced a truth that I know and yet is hard for me to articulate.
Yes.
And when I was a Christian, you could have beat me in an instant with your logical arguments, because I also at that point just believed it because it felt beautiful and it felt accurate and it felt true. Sometimes that's what it looks like.
Right.
Sometimes you just have to, what you really have to do is you have to listen to and trust yourself. And sometimes the answer you're looking for was kind of in there the whole time, but you have to learn how to hear it and to trust it. And in my case, it was just like, be the kind of person who loves yourself, who's proud of yourself,
yeah.
Take risks, show up for people who need it, and just keep doing that.
Yeah.
Like, just keep doing that. Just keep being brave, keep reading books, keep showing up. As long as you can. Yes. That's my life philosophy. And ultimately, I think, like, in this conversation, I got to be my genuine self with you. And that it's just nice when you hear that self speak and you're like, I like that guy.
Yes.
He's all right, you know?
Oh, man. Well, Colin, thank you for being your genuine self. I think, again, that your story is important. I know that it will resonate with people. We are doing this as a Deconversion Anonymous episode. So what we'll do is this. if you're interested in reaching out to Colin, you can email me at gracefulatheist@gmail.com and I will forward that along to Colin. Colin will then have the opportunity to respond in whatever way he wants. Colin, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you. Honestly, I'm blown away by what you do. And I'm so glad that I got to listen to it, be a fan of it, and then to have this experience. It really actually means a lot that you create this space for people to tell their story, you know, even when they're scared. So thank you.
I appreciate it. Final thoughts on the episode. This conversation was so much fun. I laughed so much. I'm sure that my maniacal giggling became annoying. Colin is obviously an amazing storyteller. He's obviously an amazing comedian. But what is so compelling about his story is the rawness and the honesty in the way that he tells it. Talking about going to therapy, dealing with depression, being a virgin later in life, discovering himself, that he loved himself. These are just amazing themes that are often heard in the deconversion process, especially for those of you who were raised in evangelical households. There are lifelong effects into your adulthood. I think the hope on the other side is to hear that Colin has discovered himself and discovered a way of thriving, not just surviving. I love the way he says, "My first and only real religion is inclusion," and how he recognized that at such an early age. I mentioned at the top of the show that a fun part of doing these podcasts is getting to talk to people who have independently come to the same conclusions. And again, we use different terminology. I call this secular grace. Colin is talking about inclusion. But we're really saying the same things from just slightly different perspectives. Colin and I could have geeked out about comedy and movies for hours and hours and hours. I really just want to thank Colin for the courage to share his story the way he did. And to quote him, "I know you better, Colin. I see you. I'm amazed at the courage you've shown, the honesty you've shown, and I can't wait to watch what you do with the talent that you have." As we mentioned, this is a Deconversion Anonymous show, but Colin did want to make himself available. So if you are interested in contacting Colin, email me, gracefulatheist@gmail.com, and I will forward that along to Colin, and that gives Colin the opportunity to decide how to respond. If you are still listening, you are a dedicated podcast listener and fan of the show. Every so often, I make this plea, and I'm going to make it again. You'll notice that in this episode, we did a bit more of thematic orientation with the musical pauses. I've recognized that this is not my particular area of expertise, and though I ask for this every once in a while, I'm interested again if anybody is out there who wants to team up to do podcast production with a storyteller's heart, with a humanist secular grace need to outreach. If you're that person out there, please get in touch with me, gracefulatheist@gmail.com. I'm very excited that the next episode will be with my wife, Michelle. She and I had a conversation now several weeks ago. I'll be editing that one in a similar way, hopefully using every bit of my amateur abilities to make the best podcast I can. I hope that for those of you who are out there who are in relationships with people you love dearly, who don't share your particular faith position, whether that is with or without faith, that this can give some tiny amount of hope that it can be done. Until then, my name is David, and I am trying to be the graceful atheist. Join me and be graceful human beings. Time for some footnotes. The song is a track called Waves by Micaiah Beats. Please check out her music. Links will be in the show notes. If you'd like to help support the podcast, here are the ways you can go about that. First, help promote it. A podcast's audience grows by word of mouth. If you found it useful or just entertaining, please pass it on to your friends and family. Post about it on social media so that others can find it. Please rate and review the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. This will help raise the visibility of our show. Join me on the podcast. Tell your story. Have you gone through a faith transition? You want to tell that to the world? Let me know and let's have you on. Do you know someone who needs to tell their story? Let them know. Do you have criticisms about atheism or humanism, but you're willing to have an honesty contest with me? Come on the show. If you have a book or a blog that you want to promote, I'd like to hear from you. Also, you can contribute technical support. If you are good at graphic design, sound engineering, or marketing, please let me know and I'll let you know how you can participate. And finally, financial support. There will be a link on the show notes to allow contributions, which would help defray the cost of producing the show. If you want to get in touch with me, you can Google Graceful Atheist, or you can send email to gracefulatheist@gmail.com. You can tweet at me at gracefulatheist, or you can just check out my website at gracefulatheist.wordpress.com. Get in touch and let me know if you appreciate the podcast. Well, this has been the Graceful Atheist podcast. My name is David, and I am trying to be the Graceful Atheist. Grab somebody you love and tell them how much they mean to you. This has been the Graceful Atheist podcast.